listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
If something like a ban on a bank or currency use follows, it will amount to a declaration of economic war.
That was Russia's Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev speaking on Friday in Kamchatka, Russia, about the latest announced U.S. sanctions against his country.
And it will warrant a response with economic means, political means, and if necessary, other means. Our American friends should understand that.
For a deeper understanding of the present regime of U.S. sanctions against Russia and the history of U.S. economic warfare against Russia and the Soviet Union, we spoke with Mark Sloboda, senior lecturer at Moscow State University on international relations. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow Friday.
Certainly economic warfare. I mean, the U.S. has been waging that against, the Soviet Union. Aside from a brief period in the 1990s under Yeltsin, which the U.S. helped keep in power when the U.S. was meddling in Russian elections in 1996. And the cover of Time magazine proudly proclaims we saved Russia, yep, i.e. from itself, in a election that is widely regarded in Russia by academics, experts, to have been rigged, and that the communist challenger, Zhuganov, probably should have actually won that election. But that aside, I mean, at the start of the Bolshevik Revolution, I mean, in 1919, during the Polar Bear Expedition, as it's quite interestingly termed in the United States, the U.S., United Kingdom, other Western powers, and Japan actually invaded the Soviet Union in an attempt to strangle it in its cradle, as it were. Right. Something that failed after about a year of various efforts that even included Winston Churchill, then as the Secretary of War for the then still British Empire, to use chemical weapons on Russian villages, something that has only recently been fully admitted to in the pages of The Guardian and elsewhere. But economic war has been more oft the method of pursuit. And it certainly has increased in recent days. Now, you have to understand that Russia and the United States do not actually do a lot of trade.
Right.
Last year, the total trade between the two countries was a rather paltry, about $20 billion worth going both ways.
Right.
And that's a large trade deficit on the towards Russia. The U.S. buys amazingly more from Russia than Russia does from the United States. A big portion of that is actually gasoline.
Right.
Russia is the number two country that the United States imports processed gasoline from. As a result of these latest sanctions, if they come to full fruition in the fall, then expect your gasoline prices to be going up in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But this latest round of sanctions, this comes on the heels of about four or five rounds of sanctions so far that have been leveled on Russia in just the last 2 years, just over three if we count the Sergei Magnitsky Act as well.
Mm.
Most of them under extremely dubious provenance. Be that this Sergei Magnitsky Act, which is a pretty much fiction concocted by the vulture neoliberal capitalist Bill Browder, who has a personal vendetta against the Russian government because he made off sweetly in the 90s, raiding the country and then sucking as much out of it as he could, like some type of vampire squid.
Yeah.
But when Putin became president, he quickly put an end to that. And
right.
Browder, having avoided paying any taxes to the Russian government on the money he was making, fled the country. His accountant, he presents him as a lawyer. He was actually his accountant at the time. Sergei Magnitsky, a Russian citizen, was arrested and died in prison. Mm-hmm. He was already of ill health when he went into prison. The story of that facilitated these sanctions is that he was killed in prison. The more realistic version is that he was denied maybe some advanced medical care that might have saved his life from already existing conditions. And that maybe is the most likely scenario of what resulted in his death, which you can still find some fault with, but certainly.
Well, it sounds like he had an American insurance company's health plan. They didn't include pre-existing conditions, that's all.
It's certainly not something you sanction an entire country.
Right.
That was just a pretext, and I think it's widely known. So then we've seen sanctions for the supposed meddling in the U.S. elections, the brainwashing of the naive and gullible American people who are tricked into voting against their own best interest by Facebook memes about puppies and so on.
Right.
Then we saw a 60 diplomats kicked out of the United States, 60 right. Russian diplomats. This was then followed up with much smaller numbers by most of the countries of the European Union and Canada as well, a few other allied countries, you know, the West, as it were, supposedly over a chemical weapon attack on a former British double agent, Sergei Skripal, and his daughter, supposedly with a military-grade toxin, a super secret toxin developed in the Soviet Union, which the United Kingdom, the British government, tried to claim only Russia could have.
Right.
And that this is supposed to be 10 times more powerful than VX, a nerve agent that the New York Times termed as too deadly to use.
Right.
Except for the fact that neither of the Skripals died.
No, and one of them wants to go back to Russia.
Yeah,
the daughter.
But they are being held incommunicado in CIA custody somewhere, evidently. But this latest round of sanctions is supposedly once again over that. And the reason for that is kind of an obscure 1991 law, the Chemical and Biological Weapons Control and Warfare Elimination Act. And this was created back in 1991, you know, when the Soviet Union was collapsing. And it's a piece of domestic legislation that basically seeks to force the hand of the executive branch. And what it says is that if the president makes a determination that a country is either stockpiling chemical or biological weapons or has used them in violation of international law, then there is, if he makes such a determination, then there's a series of events that culminates in two potential rounds of sanctions that are mandated. And because evidently Donald Trump made such a determination when he kicked the Russian diplomats out of the U.S. over the Skripal affair. And it should be said once again that no evidence whatsoever has been provided of Russian involvement in this non-assassination.
That's right.
Never mind, you know, the obvious that if Russia actually wanted to assassinate people, I have no doubt, one, that they would be dead, and two, that they wouldn't leave a glowing a super secret Soviet weapon trail leading back to the country. No evidence has been presented. No suspects have been named. There even hasn't been any type of real determination of how this Novichok super secret Soviet chemical agent was applied.
Right.
Never mind the dozen or so other countries that it has pretty much been shown could have it, including the United Kingdom itself,
right,
including the former countries of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, including in the United Kingdom, a laboratory that's like 9 miles away from the site or something.
Yeah, Porton Downs. Right. Russia, just yesterday. Yesterday, the Russian foreign ministry spokesman, Maria Zakharova, made the demand back to the United Kingdom that Porton Downs be investigated.
You think?
Of course, that won't happen. The U.S. could have it because they closed down the facilities in Uzbekistan that were actually responsible for making it during the Soviet Union. Several Eastern European countries evidently developed the ability to produce it. So the idea that only Russia has it or only Russia could have used it is a complete fiction. In fact, one of the people who worked on the program, who has since defected in the United States, he wrote a book that you can get on Amazon that tells you how to make it. And he says that anyone with little more than a garage chemical laboratory in the back of their house could produce it. There's so many inconsistencies in this story of this Skripal non-assassination that is supposedly the cause of this. But President Trump evidently made such a determination. The Russians are responsible. You have to trust us on that. This latest round of sanctions evidently came as somewhat of a surprise to the Russian government. They didn't seem to know that it was in the works, but evidently the procedure's pretty much been on autopilot since Trump made that determination. After that, there were 60 days, basically, after the determination to begin the round of sanctions. Evidently, the Trump administration delayed an extra about 30 days. So it's actually a month past due. But the first mandated bit of sanctions is about dual-use technology. This is about any type of scientific or engineering equipment that could potentially also have military use. Now, Obama already put sanctions on this type of thing, such that each individual export license from an American company to Russia has to be approved on a case-by-case basis. But this would set the automatic presumption of such export licenses to no.
Gotcha.
And so, then there would be a case-by-case possible exemption from this. The one notable exemption that they made, as always, is on the space
technology. Since because the U.S. can't put anything into orbit without hitching a rod out of
Russia. U.S. can't get their astronauts to or from the space station and has problem even putting satellites in orbit without the Russian Soyuz and Russian rocket engines.
That's right.
So, of course, right now, that is one of the things that the Russian Duma members are loudly demanding that Russia retaliate with if this all comes to pass, because they know that that would actually hurt the United States. Although the Putin administration has been very loath to touch space cooperation with the United States. One, because the U.S. does pay. Of course, for this rights, and that helps keep the Russian space program afloat, something they can't seem to do with their own NASA, at least not with as regards to getting people into space, although it seems to me that China would make a much better partner, a much more reliable partner for Russia with regards to space exploration and scientific work these days than the United States.
And it may well come to that, too, it appears.
We'll see if anything comes of that. But after this first round comes into effect, then there is a 90-day period. And then after that 90-day period, that starts August 22nd, 90 days after that, Russia is supposed to have by then apologized for using chemical weapons, made assurances that they will never do so again, and allow on-site inspections of supposed chemical facilities by some neutral third party. We would presume the Organization of Prohibition of Chemical Weapons or possibly some other UN body. Now, here's the ironic thing about the US and Russia had bilateral treaties to get rid of their chemical weapons stockpiles. Right. Yep. This also came about at the beginning of the 90s. Right. And Russia actually has completed its elimination.
Right.
It has eliminated all of its chemical weapons stockpiles and production facilities. And this has all been certified multiple times by the Organization of Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, including most recently in September of last year.
Right.
The U.S. has not fulfilled its own obligations under that treaty and has not destroyed its chemical weapons.
I think the word refuses is applicable here. They refuse to do it.
Yes, they it would seem that is the case, although they haven't come right out and said that. They certainly do have the capability and have not followed through on doing that for whatever reason. I even find it hard to understand because of the absolute futility of using chemical weapons in any type of battlefield situation, the uselessness of them generally, and not to mention the international opprobrium and so on. But so if Russia doesn't do these things, which it has already quite frankly, regards as an insult, and it will not, because it says that it has nothing to do with the Skripal affair. And one of the interesting things about this, the ongoing investigation, Russia's guilt was declared immediately before the investigation even began, but that this whole procedure, it is actually the United Kingdom, the British government, that is in violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention, because there is a procedure that all of the countries that are signatories of the convention, which obviously includes Russia and the United Kingdom, that if United Kingdom has a problem with an incident such as this, they are supposed to share information and sit down and have talks with the people they think are in violation of the convention in any way, which, of course, they have not done. They have not provided any of the requested information to the Russian government, or anyone else for that matter, regarding the samples, the chemical samples, and so on. That investigation is ongoing. But at the end of those 3 months, the provisions that are mandated by the Elimination Act are actually pretty severe, even for the two countries that don't do a lot of bilateral trade. And of course, the big problem with the United States sanctioning countries like Russia and Iran is not just the closing down of those countries, but the U.S. then using the commanding heights of the global financial system to block anyone else and to sanction anyone else willing to trade with those countries, as it has promised to do over both Iran and Russia. It has threatened to sanction EU companies that do trade with Iran and Russia over gas and other things.
That's right.
Also to deny international credit, which filters down through private institutions, and no one wants to make loans and somewhere. And that's where the actual problems come in. So at the end of those 3 months, these conditions come in. One would be termination of assistance under the Foreign Assistance Act. Okay, no particular big deal there. Termination of arms sales and arms sales financing. Okay, we have to presume the U.S. doesn't buy too much other than space-related from Russia. Denial of U.S. credit. Okay, we've already been working towards that, but that would be an absolute, complete, utter denial. Prohibition of the export of certain goods and technologies. Directs such weapons. One, opposition to the extension of multilateral development bank assistance, meaning preventing any type of World Trade Organization or IMF assistance, prohibition of any U.S. bank loans, except loans for food or agricultural commodities, further export prohibitions, import restrictions, suspension of diplomatic relations, which seems to be an absolute total suspension of diplomatic relations, and the termination of air carrier landing rights. And because we have to presume that Russia would immediately reply in kind to that, it essentially means that direct flights between the U.S. and Russia, certainly on any U.S. or Russian carriers, would end. That you would definitely have to take a third country carrier to get, and you would probably then have to go through a third country in order to travel from Russia to the United States.
Right.
Which is something that we didn't even, of course, see during the Cold War.
Right.
But hidden in those provisions there is what has been described in the press as a complete ban on all imports and exports from imports from and exports to Russia.
Mm.
A total ban.
You know, it's interesting looking at this. I mean, there are so many immediate contradictions. For example, I flew to Moscow in July on Aeroflot, which is one of the things they're talking about, banning Aeroflot from landing here.
It wouldn't just be Aeroflot, but of course that is largest Russian carrier.
Okay, and I flew on a Boeing 777, a plane that goes for somewhere between $250 and $350 million each. It gets paid to Boeing when the airline either buys or leases them. Boeing gets a big fat check. They hire employees out in Washington or wherever out in the Pacific Northwest to build these things. And so I'm assuming that a carrier like Aeroflot if they're banned from the U.S., they're going to stop buying American planes. And so the impact is larger here than it is on the traffic between the U.S. and Russia, which isn't all that. There's that kind of contradiction. But here's an even bigger one. It was one thing when back in the 80s, for example, when the U.S. was really cranking down economic warfare on the Eastern Bloc, and you had so many things that were not available in the Soviet Union. I mean, they couldn't make everything there. They just rebuilt the economy again after World War II. And so some things you had to buy from the West, and they wouldn't take rubles. They wouldn't take a lot of currency. You could either do some swap deals, or there were things you couldn't get, like electronics from Japan and a lot of American goods. Well, now all those goods, and by the way, most of those technologies for PCs and stuff, they're from China. And China has already declared that it is a strategic partner of Russia. And so there's a whole different condition in which this economic warfare takes place than there was 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Yeah, and it has to be said that in the last few years, Russia has already made steps towards decoupling its economy, in particular from the U.S., but from the West in general. So they've already made large strides in that direction, be that import
also.
Substitution,
right.
its own retaliatory sanctions on agricultural goods in the EU and so far. Just recently, Russia has almost completely divested itself of dollar reserves.
Right.
It has sold off some 80% of its dollar reserves and seems to be heading there with the rest of it. Right. And Russia was at the time just a couple weeks ago, the sixth largest foreign holder of U.S. debt.
Right.
So not an insignificant total by any. And they've reinvested a lot of that in gold reserves.
Right.
As kind of a stormy weather.
Yeah. Hedge.
Scenario. Yep. But a big part of this, of course, is Russia has put retaliatory sanctions on the EU for the previous rounds of sanctions.
Right.
Americans like to believe that these sanctions that they have put on Russia have the country on its knees. Obama made the absolutely amazing statement that the Russian economy is in tatters before he left office.
Yeah.
And I'm like, where does he get this from?
I don't know.
I mean
he's been there.
What his aides were telling him. He also said the Russian economy doesn't produce anything,
Oil
except for things like Kaspersky and the largest exporter of nuclear reactors to the rest of the world, building pipelines in countries around the world.
Right.
And ferrying your astronauts' butts to and from the space station. Little things like that,
which is something that actually occurred during Obama's time, wasn't it? I think Obama was the first president who sat over a country that didn't have the capacity to put its own stuff in space.
Yeah. So in the first year of sanctions against Russia that started with Obama, in 2014. So in 2015, the total cumulative damage to the Russian economy, as assessed by the U.S. Treasury Department, of all cumulative of all Western sanctions against Russia, was to trim 1 to 1.5% off of Russia's GDP.
That's it.
Now, it was coupled with an oil price war with Saudi Arabia.
Right, that hurt.
Saudi Arabia overproduced. Now, that actually knocked a good 6-7% off of Russia's GDP for a few years until Saudi Arabia blinked.
Right.
And they gave up that oil price war, and they've since cooperated bilaterally to bring the price back up to a level that's good for both countries.
Yeah, and actually, even today, as a matter of fact, the Saudi sovereign wealth fund is like scrambling. scrambling for resources. Yeah. That's a headline.
They put themselves into bankruptcy. Now, that was targeted against both Russia and Iran. Venezuela was an added bonus, of course, for the U.S., right? But that actually did some damage. But the U.S. sanctions, they really – I mean, I know American politicians like to feel that they've done something, but they really didn't. And it really goes to the futility of sanctions as a foreign policy coercion tool. I mean, there's the whole question of whether these type of unilateral sanctions are even legal under international law.
For sure.
Most readings regard them as an act of aggression.
That's right.
It's an act of war. Is the capital crime under international law, unless they are specifically approved by the UN Security Council.
That's right.
Which, of course, obviously not the case.
So, and meanwhile, Russia, I mean, they're threatening tariff actions against Turkey. Yeah. Erdogan's talking about economic war, okay, at the same time that they're trying to balance, the U.S. is trying to balance a relationship with, you know, Turkey is looking towards Russia strategically, and what are they doing? I mean, it's insane. They're declaring economic war against the whole world, China, everybody else.
Yeah, that's the thing, against China. Hundreds of billions of dollars worth of tariffs, potential and retaliation in kind against China. They're putting tariffs against their allies in South Korea across Europe, in South America, against Brazil. Some of the largest tariffs have actually gone against Canada.
Right.
Some against Mexico.
So there's like this whole pile of stuff. Look, on the one hand, you can see the economic reasons. If they want to sit across the table from China and play hardball to say, we're going to change the tariff structure, we're going to do this and that, there's at least some economic reason and logic to it. But if you're going to play that game strategically, you got to be on your game. And doing this to Russia makes absolutely no sense at all. There's no real compelling economic reason or political or strategic reason to do that.
Well, the U.S. is threatening sanctions against Turkey and India if they and potentially Saudi Arabia if they buy Russian weapons. They're threatening sanctions against EU companies for doing business with Iran and Russia. They're threatening essentially economic war with the whole world at once.
Right.
A great deal of it seems to be for domestic political reasons.
Right.
For Trump
right.
fulfilling his promises to the American workers, none of which will actually benefit them, of course.
Of course not.
But Russia has identified this and says it's mostly about domestic partisan political politics.
Right. Which I guess they're expecting that it'll go away in November. Mark, thank you very much for your time. Pleasure as always.
Thanks for having me, Don.
Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. All across the Western world, the so-called melting pot is melting down. Immigration, legal and illegal, is probably the most contentious and divisive issue energizing voters. In Italy, for example, the right and left have united on the issue. In Germany, the government may collapse. And Trump has made this his signature cause. Can the status quo be sustained? Crosstalking Immigration, I'm joined by my guest, John Laughlin, in Paris. He's a historian and specialist in international affairs. In Bolzano, we have Roland Benedictor. He is the co-director of the Center for Advanced Studies of Eurex Research. And in Hurghada, we have Ralph Niemeyer. He is a German journalist and author. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. I'd like to go to John first in Paris. I'd like to just kind of kick this whole discussion off by an observation I've had over the last few weeks and months, particularly with the events going on in the United States, is it appears that virtue signaling has replaced policy and debate, because all we're supposed to do is to think emotionally about this and not use our heads. And I think this is what the establishment media and establishment parties want us to think that way, to address this issue. And if we stop virtue signaling, maybe we could come up with some solutions. Your thoughts, John?
Well, there's a lot of propaganda involved, isn't there, Peter? I mean, we've just seen in the events on the Mexican border these very propagandistic pictures of children supposedly being separated from their parents. I'm sure your viewers will remember the picture of the poor little Kurdish boy on a Turkish beach, the dead body of a little boy. He was a victim of the migration crisis, and the broadcast of his photo was used to elicit sympathy for the plight of migrants, and it worked very well. But when a boy of the same age was killed in a terrorist attack in Barcelona, the policy was not to show his dead body out of respect for him and for his family. So we can see that these images are being used to drive a political agenda. And that is the problem. The problem is that this immigration is being driven by a political agenda. It is being driven by a political agenda of European states who are demographically weak. The demographic pyramid is inverted. There are more old people than young people. And for many years and decades now, economists and policymakers have decided that in order to rectify this demographic problem in Europe, we need immigration. We need to bring in people from outside in order to pay our pensions. And that is the immigrationist ideology. And as long as that ideology remains in place, as long as the ideology is believed by these people, as it is most notably in Germany, then I'm afraid the problem will continue.
Okay, Roland, you know, the thing is that this is approach with open borders. But if you believe that there are open borders, then there are no borders to defend. I think that's the paradox of what's happening in the Western world. You want to have open borders, let people come in, but then you can't defend a border when it's necessary. Go ahead, Roland.
Well, look, there is no such thing like a political entity or a community without borders, never in history. And you need borders. Why? Because you have to define the limits of validity of your laws. And that is what the leftist school, the Frankfurt School, Jürgen Habermas says, what the system theory says. So borders are something good and not something bad. What we had in Europe over the past decades was a very strongly leftist-oriented political correctness, which believed in a cosmopolitan definition of identity. And as, for example, the standing group identity itself of the European Consortium on Political Research in Paris and in Brussels would say today, is that we need to define our identity as Europeans much more in a European way,
right,
and in a less exaggerated cosmopolitan way, because we cannot live without borders, because if you have no borders, you have no rule of law and no definition where your laws are valid and where not.
Okay, Ralph, let me go to you. I mean, okay, we have a lot of consensus here. The media is for open borders. The political class is for open borders. But you know what? The voters aren't for open borders. And we're seeing it in election after election. I mean, isn't it time that democracy be recognized again in the European Union? I mean, we have the Austrians, we have the Italians, we have also a new, I could use the term fifth column in Germany right now, that it's waking up to what voters want. And they're running on these issues. Go ahead, Ralph.
Yes, of course it's true that the open border myth, I must say, of leftists, and I am calling myself a leftist, is at stake, because it has not worked out fine. And we left behind those people who already live in our country, and we did not take care of them. Although refugees had nothing to do with the fact that the pensions were not good enough anymore. This was due to privatization of the pension scheme, or that the wages are not good enough, or that the rent is too high for apartments. This is all not due to the refugee crisis, but it came up with that now, that people are realizing that they were left behind, and they say, hang on a minute, now foreigners are coming as well. So this is where the leftists made a key mistake in the recent years, and especially when 2015 happened, when Mrs. Merkel once and for all did a decision, said, wir schaffen das, we are going to manage, in English. Then people said, yeah, but why don't we manage with ourselves first? And of course, this is where right-wing and nationalistic parties are coming up now, because they take voter sentiment serious, where leftists have failed to do that, and especially the German leftists have failed completely in that. They still demand open borders, like if there were no borders and no states, which is, of course, not true. There are states, and we need states, of course, and otherwise we have anarchy, and no one wants to live in anarchy. And I think this is also what brings down the Merkel government now, because she lost control.
Yeah, but John, you know, the interesting thing is with these waves of migrants or asylum seekers or whatever term you want, because it seems to me most of them, vast majority for economic immigrants here. But, you know, they don't really come in on Lear jets, do they, to Germany? They don't, you know, they don't fly into airports. They kind of walk through the continent. You know, that's what makes me feel really bad for the Greeks and the Italians, okay? I mean, if Germany wants those people, fine, but it's not being done the right way, even according to EU laws, okay? So, I mean, Germany cannot be the decision maker of immigration in Europe. That is intensely anti-democratic and against the rules of the European Union. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the rules are being broken, because indeed Germany, by saying that a million refugees are welcome and then by trying to offload them onto other members of the European Union, was indeed breaking refugee law and breaking the European Union's own rules, that's for sure. I'm in strong agreement with what Roland said about borders and the need to protect them, but I have a different conclusion. I disagree that this is a European problem, and indeed I think that that this can be solved with European measures. And I think that the reflex position of European leaders, which is to say that we need a European solution to this problem, is precisely wrong. It is precisely the fact that we have a European Union with a borderless internal space, the Schengen area, which has caused the migration problem in the first place. I first visited the Songat camp near Calais late 1990s. The migration crisis that we're talking about now didn't start in 2015. It started in the 1990s when Italy joined the Schengen zone. And from that moment onwards, the borders of the Mediterranean were on the English Channel.
Yeah.
And there is a direct relation of cause and effect. And what we saw in 2016, after Hungary and Croatia and the other countries built fences to close off the Balkan route, is that national solutions are the ones that solve this problem, not European ones. And we are now, I hope, seeing the same result with the Italians, who are taking matters into their own hands nationally, defending their national territory. And it's only by doing that, because they have the navy, they have the ability to do it, that this solution will end. Prior to the imposition of national solutions, the habit was, and it's a very bad structural problem in the EU, it was that countries would simply let the migrants in, like Greece and Italy, and then send them north to Germany. In other words, there were beggar thy neighbor policies, right, which is a structural problem in the EU. So I think we need to finish with this idea that the solution is European, the problem is European.
Roland, the argument that the left and the media have made is that, and it's already been mentioned in this program, I think it was you, demographics, the need for workers, new workers. But, I mean, looking at the evidence, I don't see a lot of these migrants, particularly since 2015, are employed across the European Union. They do take state benefits. And in most of the countries of the European Union have austerity, so you have very large youth unemployment. So why this impulse to keep bringing in more people, unless it's just cheap labor? Go ahead, Roland.
Yeah, indeed, this is a myth, especially if we take into account the current trend toward automatization. Large parts of the traditional labor force, especially blue-collar workers, will be dismissed over the coming years. And unfortunately, most of those who come in an irregular ways to Europe do not have an education, do not have any kind of qualification. And a recent study of the European Ministry of Labour admitted that it was very difficult to qualify more than 20-25% of all coming over the coming years to get a job. And in fact, the job acceptance rate, the employment rate of migrants and refugees is very low. So this is indeed a problem, and this is a myth that is partly to be dismissed, because it will always less correspond to the truth. But let me just say something to my previous speaker. I'm in many ways of his opinion that we need a dramatic change in the immigration policy, because we cannot go on like this. And I think more and more Europeans have understood this, as the recent elections all over Europe have shown.
Okay,
on the other hand,
all right, gentlemen, I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on immigration. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Roland. You want me, right before we went to the rink, you wanted to finish your point. Please do.
Yeah, just wanted to say that I'm not of the same opinion in one crucial point, which is I think we need more Europe and not less Europe to solve the crisis. And I give you a practical example. Today, we have to harmonize the asylum laws, and that is the most urgent issue to solve. Today, it is possible that a migrant that is not accepted in one country, for example, in Germany, can just switch country and restart applying in another country, for example, in Italy or in France. And if it doesn't succeed, he or she doesn't succeed there, they just switch on and go further. We have to harmonize the laws to accept asylum seekers. We have to harmonize the registration. And of course, we have to harmonize the declaration of secure third countries of origin. For example, Germany has declared parts of Afghanistan a secure country and doesn't accept asylum seekers. They just switched to Italy and are accepted because Italy has not declared parts of Afghanistan as secure. So we have urgently to find transnational European solutions for these problems. Otherwise, we will not be able to stop the crisis.
Okay, I can see in Paris John is really disagreeing. Let me go to Ralph real quick. But it seems to me that, Roland, you want to create the United States of Europe. And everything to date shows that's not what people want. No one ever asked the Europeans if they ever wanted that. Ralph, let me go to you. A very important issue that isn't being brought up here, and this applies to the United States and Europe, is that there are criminal gangs making a fortune off of this scam, okay? Bringing people in there, NGOs, you know, the do-gooders, but no, they're blinded by ideology. They're ideologically possessed. They have a hatred for their own culture, a hatred for Europe. They want to just wipe it away and fill it up with foreign alien people. I'm sorry to sound so politically incorrect, but that is true, particularly the criminal gangs in the Mexican border and all through the Mediterranean. You have a lot of people preying on some very weak people. And I'd like to point out also that it's often forgotten, the people that do want to immigrate to the United States and to Europe, they should stay in their own country and build their own country, okay? Instead of having the West have to subsidize them in their home country where they left. Okay, that's a lot said right there. Go ahead, Ralph.
Yeah, well, I do agree to a certain extent, because I once raised that question even in a press conference with Mrs. Merkel, and she made the same mistake that many people do at this. Also, in our discussion, I hear now that we mix migration issues with asylum. You know, to uphold the asylum, the right of asylum, which is a human right, and we have to uphold that for those who need it, we cannot mix that issue with migration. Now, what I do agree with is that what we see at the moment at the Mexican border is probably set up by deep state or by some people who want to make Mr. Trump act, and Mr. Trump is not falling for it because he remembers what happened to Mrs. Merkel when she suddenly had the refugees coming in, and this was advertised as the Balkan route by the media. Now, at the beginning of this year, sometime in spring, I watched a program on CNN. Where there was a colleague on a bus tour from Central America towards the U.S. border and reporting from it and advertising it, kind of saying, oh, this is the way to go to the United States. Of course, you can instigate that. Yeah. And obviously, Mr. Trump is facing this now. Nobody wants to see these crying children and parents being arrested and all that. I don't think that he wants to see that. But it's now a fact that they want to carry him over a red tape. Like they did with Mrs. Merkel, and then it was the only two times she only governed in the last 12 years. Was one decision was about a financial crisis, and she pumped billions into ailing banking systems. The second decision she made during her 12-year reign was in 2015 to say, okay, these people sleeping on train stations, they can come. But after that, she lost control. And this is why people are voting for right-wing parties. And leftists do make the mistake, especially in Germany, I see that, that they do not have an answer to these sentiments of people. We are able to take many more refugees. It's not a problem because we are a rich country. But we have to take care of the people who are already in Germany first. And then we can say we can accept migrant workers. But asylum should be always be separate from that because there is no limit to that. That's a human right.
You know, John, a lot has been said since you last spoke there. And I can read your mind this far away that more Europe is not the solution. Juxtaposition what our friend Roland had to say. Go ahead, John.
Yes, I wanted to come back to that point in response to the question you asked about the economic rationale. You rightly put your finger on the paradox that immigration is justified economically because it keeps wages down and gives a supply of cheap labour and so on. But that in reality, of course, many of the migrants end up being out of work. And in any case, there's a lot of youth unemployment in Europe. By asking that question, Peter, you have highlighted the point I made in my first answer, namely that the ideological reasons that I referred to, which are European, are not motivated by economic good sense. We can have a debate about whether or not you need cheap labour. Britain, by the way, is an economic model for that because Britain has imported millions of low-cost workers from Poland and Romania since 2004, and we've seen the effects of that on the economy, an increase in GDP and a collapse in productivity. But that's not what's driving the immigration ideology. It's precisely not economic rationale. It is instead ideology. You know, it's important to recall that one of the founding fathers of the European integrationist movement, Richard von Coudenhove-Kalergi, in 1925 called for the races of Europe to be mixed with other bloods, for the European race to be mixed with other bloods in order to create a new European of the future. He had a sort of racialist view, except the other way around from the Nazis. Right. He wanted racial mixity, racial diversity. And this idea, which he first published in 1925, he's a big figure. He was the first president of the Council of Europe, for example. This idea remains alive today in the minds of European leaders, particularly, incidentally, German ones. Wolfgang Schäuble, now president of the Bundestag, for many years the German Minister of Finance, said in an interview in Die Zeit in 2016 that if we didn't have migrants and we kept them out, then Europe would descend into incest. He used the word incest. And similarly, the German president, Joachim Gauck, said that we needed migrants to get rid of the idea that being German means being white and being Christian. So there is a very clear ideological drive here to inject new populations into Europe in order to change the structure of those populations. And that is part of the European dream. It's part of the post-national European dream.
But
and
John,
it goes very, very far
but
indeed.
John,
and that's why I say Europe is not the answer.
How would that make Europe better? I don't get it, okay? I travel through Europe all the time. I don't see it's improving. I see it's declining rapidly. Go ahead. Yeah. Finish up, John.
Peter, the Bolshevik Revolution didn't make Russia better, but that didn't mean that people didn't believe in it. They believed in it because it's an ideology. It's a post-national ideology, which these people want to implement by replacing the population. In their crazy minds, that's what they're doing.
Okay, Roland, you know, Italy has been hit very hard by this immigration crisis, we can use that word. I mean, shouldn't Italy on its own be able to decide what happens with inside its borders? I mean, why is it waiting for Merkel? Why is it waiting for Brussels? Why is it waiting for this summit that's going to happen in the weekend? I mean, Italy's a sovereign country. It should take care of its people first, particularly it's the unemployment of its youth, which is critical right now. Go ahead, Roland. Italians have to decide for themselves. Go ahead.
Well, that is exactly what is happening now after the last elections of March 4. We had the biggest shift to the right ever in post-World War II history in Italy. And in fact, the new government is blocking NGO ships, saying they are not democratically controlled. The new government is seeking the participation of Spain and is putting Merkel, especially the German chancellor, under strong pressure to find a different solution. The only solution that is needed in Europe is to control the outer borders. We have to retake control, as the European Council President Donald Tusk of Poland stated already in 2014. We have to regain control of our outer borders.
Yeah, but what about, I'm sorry, Roland, what about Italy's borders? What about Italy's borders? Isn't that the first thing you should be thinking about first? Sure. As an Italian?
Sure. The sad thing is that in this point, you're absolutely right. Italy is forced to take control over its own borders, made more or less alone. Why? I give you the example, Frontex, which is the official agency of border protection in Europe, is based in Warsaw and features 404 collaborators to protect the whole of the outer border of Europe. And has a total budget of 281 million, which is 100th of what Germany alone spends per year for the refugees, which is a disproportion that cannot be upheld.
We disproportion? Need that, yeah, that's an understatement, my friend. That's an understatement, okay? Wow, that's amazing. Let me go to Ralph here. I mean, Ralph, if we could put aside all the ideology and all of the virtue signaling, what some concrete things to do? In the United States, I think there should be built a wall. Then there won't be any children torn from their parents, okay? It won't happen. What can Europe do as a first step in your mind, a practical step?
Well, I'm from West Berlin, and I know how it is to live on an island surrounded by a wall, and we don't want to see walls anymore. But I understand that in the United States it's a different story. And of course, the wall that we had was to keep people from fleeing from their country.
Yep.
Not into a country. So it's a bit different, of course, to compare these two walls. Generally, I think there should be better ways. Now, we as Europeans, we should commonly discuss how we can make life better in countries where migrants have to leave their country because they feel not safe. The second point is we can, of course, improve things in those countries by renegotiating the EPA, the European Partnership Agreement with Africa. I've spent a lot of time now in Africa at the moment, and we see that it's not
Ralph, we're almost out of time, but one thing the West could do is stop bombing those countries so these people won't flee, okay? Yeah. That would be a first good practical step. We've run out of time, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Paris, Bolzano and Regatta, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.